Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. Today we're going to do a debrief on my debate on the resurrection with Doug from the Pine Creek channel. If you haven't checked that out yet, that should be the video before this one here on our YouTube channel or on the podcast list. Be sure to go listen to it. I thought it went very well. I thought it was a very instructive debate. Doug was a good interlocutor, better than I had expected. And that's good because we were able to raise some important issues. So we're going to talk about that, talk about some of the dynamics related to the debate. But to help us do that, I have invited Eric Manning onto the show. He runs isjesusalive.com, head of a reasonable faith chapter. Sorry, I didn't read your bio more. Eric, welcome to the show.
Oh, yeah. No problem, man. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I also have the YouTube channel Testify. It's probably where, if I do know, I have some of your people who watch your channel overlap with mine, and so they might know me from that as well.
No, that's great. And the reason I wanted to bring you on just to do a debrief here, because as I was doing study and preparation for my debate with Doug, I came across your work, and I've been familiar with your work before, and I thought it brought up a lot of important elements to defending the resurrection that people don't think of a lot. So we'll talk about that a little bit later. But first, I want to get your overall thoughts on the debate that I had with Doug, and just your thoughts on his kind of unique approach to this issue to fill some more of our listeners in. So we could talk a little bit about that if you want.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. No, I thought you did a really good job, like right out of the gate, taking away a lot of Doug's they were mistaken kind of objections with the apostles. And so you really kind of tore apart the hallucination type of hypothesis or different things that he might have thrown out there kind of ahead of time. And I thought that was really good. I think you pointed out that most of Doug's objections really just rest on a lot of hypothetical scenarios. Doug was big fan of throwing out like these different hypotheticals and things like that. And I thought you did a good job pointing out that he never really does necessarily interact with the evidence for the resurrection.
Right.
Doug's job is just kind of, let me cast some doubts.
Well, that's his background. Kind of, and I think that's important for people to understand. So the person I was debating, Doug at the Pine Creek channel, he's an interesting guy in that he is fairly knowledgeable on apologetics and counter apologetics. But I believe that his knowledge comes primarily, if not solely, through watching videos and debates online. I don't think that I think he's even made fun of like hitting the books a lot on this subject. He watches lots and lots of videos. He makes very long, multi-hour live streams. So I don't think he is as familiar with some of the academic scholarship, but he's quite familiar with the basic back and forth talking points on things like the resurrection from debates, from talks that people give. So he's well aware of it. He's no slouch in that regard. So I wanted to be prepared for all that. And like you said, his other background, I think people understand, is this, that he practices something called street epistemology, which is the idea of not trying to make a case for atheism per se, but just to ask people questions to cast doubt on whether they have good reasons to believe Christianity is true. So that's why I really tried to focus in the debate saying, Doug can't just say, I don't know. He's got to give us a reason, no, Jesus did not rise. And he's got to explain the evidence, not try to explain it away. So I think you think that's why I help people understand his kind of approach.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he even said, like, I don't care. You go ahead, believe in God, but you can't believe in Christianity. And he's just trying to, like I said, throw out enough doubts, you know, by throwing out these hypotheticals, like, well, if you only had the Gospel of John, would you still believe? Would you? He loves his flying man analogy.
Yes,
he really does.
And I will tell you this, that there is a part of it I did not genuinely understand until after the debate. So I'm mulling over whether maybe I'll sit down with Doug to tease it out further. Yeah, and I'll be honest with people. And this is public knowledge, basically. You know, Doug has engaged my work before. In fact, the reason I agreed to do this debate was because I was like showing up on his channel like every other day. And I'm like, dude, what's going on here? You're really interested in my stuff. Okay. But the way that he's interacted with people, I feel like he treats it more like a game of gotcha than like, because I'm totally fine having dialogues with people who disagree with me. I just have one with Alex Malpass on the Kalam argument, counter apologist, but it has to be in a kind of a good faith setting, not where I think feel like somebody is trying purposely just to trip me up and make me look silly. And Doug has said before in his interview with Randall Rouser, he likes making apologists look silly. So that's why, so people who have that attitude, I'm not as interested in a dialogue. I'll do a debate. So that's why I set it up. We had the debate. And I think it was good for people to see, all right, now Doug has to make, he has to make a case in this regard. And so the problem is I had seen him kind of act in sort of immature ways with his response videos and things that he said. And so I posed the debate because I didn't want to waste people's time with a dialogue that's not going to go anywhere. However, I thought the debate went very well. Even in our cross-examination, I enjoyed that. So I am much more open maybe to sitting down with Doug. But the point I bring up with the flying man, and I think this is his shtick with it, he's trying to figure out the point where evidence for an unusual event goes from I don't believe to I believe. And I think he thinks that there's a major problem if you can't identify that particular point. Is it martyrs? Is it multiple witnesses? Is it miracle? What is it? And this is one thing it's only come to me afterwards thinking, oh, that's the thing with the flying man, is I think this commits the fallacy of the beard. The idea being just because I can't find the precise moment something goes from unbelievable to believable doesn't mean there is no dividing line. Like, I don't know exactly, you know, I would say you've got a beard going on there, you know, somewhat. But I mean, I would say, so at the very least, it's like, I might not know exactly when stubble becomes a beard, but I can tell I don't have a beard, you have one. So I can tell when I have enough evidence for the resurrection or a miracle or an unusual event and when I don't. And so that's I think, his big sticking point. If that's the case, then it's not necessary. So I do think it's interesting, like you said, he really focuses on what would you do in these hypotheticals to show Christians are inconsistent. Mm-hmm. But as I said in the debate, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, it's so interesting he relies on hypotheticals, because it'd be way more powerful if he said, hey, here's all these other miracle claims Christians do not accept that have the same or better evidence than Christianity. So it's amazing. And he said, I can't give you that evidence. I think that's pretty powerful. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's kind of like if you were an attorney and you were like, you know, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, if I know that we have all of this evidence here, but what if we took away some of it hypothetically? Would you still find my defendant guilty? And it's like, what? Like, that doesn't even make sense. And so there's no point in these hypotheticals because we have to look at the actual evidence itself. This is just a distraction as far as I'm concerned. And so,
right.
I don't really find that to be a very good argument. Let's just talk about the evidence that we actually have.
Right. And I tried to show repeatedly in the debate that when Doug proposes alternative explanations, there are things you can't explain. Like, for example, the conversion of Paul. Like, I mean, I asked him, he said, well, maybe he was motivated by a relative who became Christian. I said, right. Oh, go ahead.
No, you're good. Go ahead. Yeah, I thought that was a very revealing moment of the debate.
Right. And I said, well, is there evidence for that? Where does it say? Well, it doesn't say that anywhere. And he said he could have had an experience before that. And I said, oh, okay, so he had an experience. What caused that? There was just like no cause, basically. And he's just throwing out there things to explain away the data. Oh, well, he had a conversion for some reason. We don't know what. Or people stole the body who are not related to the disciples in any way, shape, or form. So I think that was good to show that. And that's why I asked, because I think this is important for Christians to do on the resurrection. When skeptics argue, and I'm doing more research on this to see if I can find the evidence for it, they'll say, oh, well, it could have been grief-induced hallucinations. Peter hallucinates, and that makes everybody else have a grief hallucination. And I've looked through the literature. I'm like, well, where is a case of that happening? Mm-hmm. It's easy to pose hypothetical, like maybe this happened. Okay, because it's interesting that I feel like atheists will say, I say, oh, well, a resurrection explains all this. Ah, but we've never observed a resurrection before. So how can you postulate that? Okay, have you ever observed a group grief hallucination? Have we observed one person saying they saw a dead person that causes another person to hallucinate the same thing? And Doug said in Cross, no, I don't have any of those cases, which I thought was revealing.
Yeah, and I mean, if you think about the resurrection and the evidence that we do have, the prior probability, well, let me put it this way. The most likely thing that we would have if Jesus was just a failed Messiah who died is nothing. That's the most likely thing that we would have. That's what occupies the most probability space. You know what I'm saying? And so
you're saying we would have no resurrection claims, just like there are no resurrection claims for Theudas, the Egyptian, Simon Bar Kokhba, for all the other failed messiahs of that time period.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, when these other messiah figures or these prophets or different people from Jesus's time died, we don't have grief hallucinations. We don't have, cognitive dissonance and all these other different things. For the most part, we don't see a lot of those things. And so that's what occupies the most probability space. And so any explanation that Doug is going to offer, which he doesn't really commit to one, he just throws out, well, this is possible,
right?
And this is possible, and this is possible, and this is possible. Those already have built-in very low probability as it is, and they're clumsy. And I think Doug's thinking is just any, and I could be wrong, and Doug can correct me on this. I don't want to straw man Doug at all. You know, he's welcome to correct me if I'm wrong, but it's just like any hypothesis, no matter how clumsy that it is, and is better than a miracle hypothesis, even if it elegantly explains all the information. And I think that's just a typical kind of perspective that you'll see from a lot of skeptics.
But I feel like skeptics don't do this in regular life, because you could believe something and then you could always come up with a possible defeater to that. Like, I believe my wife loves me, but it's possible she's a Russian sleeper agent here in the United States. You know, there's no evidence for that. Just like there's no evidence that Paul grieved his persecution and that motivated him to have his hallucination. There's no evidence for that. In fact, the evidence when he recounts his life prior to his conversion, he was proud of what he was doing. It's possible, but there's no evidence for it. So like, if you live that way, you can hold on to any kind of beliefs, because there's always some kind of a possible defeater out there. So I like what you brought up about the failed messiahs. I want to bring up one point. It was interesting. It's always hard with a debate. You prepare for different arguments. You always feel bad if it didn't come up and you really wanted to talk about it. Because I think some people have said this. They've said, well, look, even if the apostles recanted, you know, or even if they paraded Jesus's corpse out there, people would still believe, or they would have cognitive dissonance and they would rewrite it in their minds. And I just don't think the historical evidence bears that out. One example is of a Messiah claimant named Sabbatai Zvi. He lived in the 17th century. And there was a movement saying that he's the Messiah. You know, there was a strong movement behind him, until he was captured by the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire, and he converted to Islam. And when he did that, so what's interesting there is that when he did that, it's not like people just forgot about it. The news of it spread and destroyed his movement. Only a tiny number of followers remained who spiritualized what he did. So for me, if that's what happened with Christianity, that yeah, they did parade Jesus's corpse, it would have destroyed the movement. And you might have had like one or two people who, and their cognitive dissonance would not be bodily resurrection. It would be spiritual survival. That's what doesn't get me about the cognitive dissonance solution. Like when you have the Seventh-day Adventists, their cognitive dissonance about, well, Jesus is going to come back in the 19th century. He didn't come. Well, he came spiritually. When you do cognitive dissonance in religion, you spiritualize it. You don't make it embodied. So that's something I feel like needs to be pushed more. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's not like as good Jews, they didn't have a system that they could fall back on to where they could still believe in God. They could still go wait for another Messiah. It's not as if they just like Jesus is off the scene now, and now everything is completely meaningless. They had a worldview that already had built into it hope for eternal life, hope for a better future, hope for Messiah, and all of these different things. They could have just gone back to being good Jews. And I think that is the most probable thing that they would have done. Now, are there groups, like you mentioned, like Seventh-day Adventists and different things that like cling to these things and spiritualize them? Well, sure, that does happen. But like you said, with the embodiedness of it versus like the spiritualization of it, I think that is kind of a separating factor. And really, when you think about it, and this is one thing, and I'd like for a skeptic to give me this. I know Matthew Harkey, I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he really is heavy into the cognitive dissonance stuff, and he works on that. I would ask him, like, can you give me examples, like, from Jesus' time or before, where these people died but yet still had this mass following and they thought that they were still alive? Because it seems like the cognitive dissonance examples that they often give are splinter Christian groups that are holding on to a failed prediction of Jesus's return or different things like that.
Right.
I don't really see a lot of these concrete. Now, they might exist and I'm just ignorant of them.
That's sure.
Why I'm asking, but yeah, like, where are these parallels? Because they seem like these are really weak parallels that I'm getting so far.
Right. Now, I want to ask you a little bit about, we might be getting into a little bit of nerdy resurrection apologetics, but that's okay, folks. It's time for us to go deep a little bit. So, one popular approach to defending the... Well, let me talk about two different approaches. Well, we're going to talk about three approaches. Let's talk about the first one. We might call it the general reliability route to the resurrection. And we say, all right, hey, look, the Bible's really reliable. It gets a lot of these details right. It's reliable stuff. And it says Jesus rose from the dead. Therefore, we should trust what it says. Very basic, truncated version. Now, a lot of people, now I don't think that's a great approach because I think Josephus is a pretty reliable Jewish historian, but I don't think that a heifer gave birth to another animal or these different miracle reports he offers. The other reason I don't believe the miracles in Josephus, I also don't believe them because they're not in his biography. They're not in Against Appian. That's a whole other issue. My point is someone could be reliable like Herodotus or Josephus, and I have problems with their miracle accounts. So a second approach would be called the minimal facts approach. Mike Lacona, Gary Habermas does this. And that would be, look, let's just look at only the facts, even if you think the Bible's unreliable. Let's only look at those bedrock facts, that minimal facts that everybody, Christian, non-Christian, agrees. Jesus was crucified. People claim to see him risen from the dead. Usually it's rooted in 1 Corinthians 15, the creed that Paul offers. And we're just starting with just the facts everybody or nearly everyone accepts, and asking what best explains those facts. And for a long time, I was really pro minimal facts, and I still am. I think it's a good argument. But in preparing for this debate, I read some of your material, some of Tim and Lydia McGrew's material, and I realized, you know, actually, I think there is a bit of a problem here, seeing what Doug would counter to me. And that would be, what if Doug says, look, you read 1 Corinthians 15, all you're getting here is appearances. Maybe they just had a fleeting psychological vision of Jesus. So that's why in the debate, people will notice, I put forward an argument, we can trust what John and Luke talked to us about an embodied appearance and was willing to go there and talk about it. I'm a convert. This is called minimal facts. I think you or someone else has called it maximal data. I'm going to tell you, I'm pretty much stepping through the door converting on this one. So maybe you could, because you've talked a little bit more about this. So I've teed it up. I want to hear more of your thoughts.
Yeah. So I did learn a lot of this from Lydia McGrew. So I'm definitely going to give her like full credit there. I was in your shoes. I was definitely a big fan of the minimal facts approach. I think like 10 years ago when I first discovered apologetics, I ran across Gary Habermas give a talk at the Veritas Forum, like the resurrection argument that changed a generation of scholars. And I just thought, well, this is really cool. And I would notice when I would talk to skeptics, like it just didn't really move the needle very much. And I just kind of didn't totally understand exactly why. But as Lydia kind of talks about, and you mentioned, basically there are a lot of scenarios that are consistent with an appearance fact. And 1 Corinthians 15, you could have a floating non-speaking Jesus. You could have a Jesus who only appears briefly, speaks a few words. Maybe he says, you know, like, hey, all is well, you know, peace be with you. And then he just disappears. And that's completely consistent with minimal facts. And I don't think that we would say that the disciples were necessarily rational to believe that. And I think if we're talking to somebody who already sets the prior probability as being kind of low, they're not going to accept that. You know what I'm saying? And so it's really difficult to assess the rationality of what the apostles were rational to believe, right? If we don't know the details, right? So we need to go to the detailed testimony that we find in the Gospels, which is a Jesus that spent 40 days with them, invited people to touch him, ate with them, they conversed with them,
right?
They saw him at all kinds of different times of the day. It was group experiences. And I think if we don't have that, I don't think that we have a very strong case, because this is why somebody like Dale Allison can throw things out there like rainbow bodies and various maybe weak apparition experiences that people have, right, and say these are pretty analogous, you know, and people are like, oh yeah, sure. And it's because Allison doesn't really put very much stock at all, as we saw in the debate with Doug, in the physicality of the resurrection.
Right. Well, Dale is, and he's a very good New Testament scholar. I see his book, Resurrecting Jesus, on my shelf. I can't reach it. And I have his recent book in 2019 on resurrection, polemics, and apologetics. And what's interesting with Dale, he just is on the seesaw back and forth. Like in resurrection, in polemics and apologetics, he'll criticize the case for the resurrection, but also make really strong arguments for the resurrection, saying like, actually these and that's why in the debate, because I knew that Doug really likes Allison's approach because he helps to cast doubt. That's why I prepared in the debate having quotes from Allison's work saying, no, Dale believes these are independent sources. He does believe these other alternative solutions have absolutely no evidence for them and all that. But you're right that, because people will say, like Allison and others, well, grief, like the term grief hallucination is very elastic. As I noticed in my research for the debate, I want to do more research because there's a lot of literature just on this is common. But what do you mean by grief hallucination? The term is so elastic. For example, I gave, you know, how long would it have been? 12, 14 years ago. When I was in my early 20s, a good friend of mine, she passed away unexpectedly when she was 19. I was like 4 years older. And so I gave the eulogy at her funeral. And I had a dream where I felt very, very real that like I was talking to her. And then I woke up. Was that a grief hallucination? I would say no, because I knew I was dreaming, but I also knew it felt more real than any dream I had ever had. But I knew it was a dream still. But when people say like, oh, there are these grief hallucinations are really, really common. Well, what's most common is you get this feeling like it feels kind of colder, or you get this weird sense the person is there, but you don't see them. You don't use any of your five senses. It's just like this sensed presence. And so there it's like, yeah, that's common, but interacting, talking, conversing, having a tactile experience, that's really, really rare. So it seems like what you're saying is, look, if we're going to, because people might just try to write this off as the sensed presence grief hallucination, which I would say is not a hallucination. We need more evidence that it is more than that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you heard Doug talk about it. He said, well, I would imagine that the appearances were like something that you would experience at a Pentecostal charismatic church. Now, somebody who spent 20 years as part of that movement, I would say that's not necessarily true. That's a massive overstatement. I don't know too many people who have gone to my church who said, oh yeah, I saw Jesus in the service today, but I do kind of know what he's talking about. We see weird stuff, you know, televangelists and right, weird people on YouTube, like Kat Kerr or something, who says she frequently visits heaven or something. And he's thinking that it's something sort of like that. And so my point is that here's a direct quote from Mike Lacona. He says, historians may conclude that subsequent to Jesus' execution, a number of his followers had experiences in individual and group settings that convinced them that Jesus had risen from the dead and it appeared to them in some manner. Well, that is very carefully worded, right? And there's just so many limitations on that, as I said, because there's so many things that you could include in that. It could have been, you know, Bart Ehrman thinks that, you know, the appearance to the 500, I think he floats the possibility that it was kind of like a pareidolia kind of experience where somebody saw it, they thought something, and then everyone was primed to believe it. And then they just kind of jumped on the bandwagon, you know?
Yeah. The 500, I want to quick talk about that, 'cause that's something apologists don't bring up often. I mentioned it in the debate, but we didn't go down that road anymore, 'cause Doug didn't just immediately scoff at the 500. And some Christians might even say, I don't even think, you know, that sounds legendary. I don't know if that's great evidence, but I actually, the more that I've studied and thought about it, thinking, no, this is actually really good evidence for several reasons. First, I mean, even Bart Ehrman in his book, Jesus, Apocalyptic Prophet, says there's a certain force to the argument of, you know, one or two people might hallucinate Jesus with 500 people. And he does, and you know, like you said, Ehrman doesn't consider it a legendary account, because some people like Doug will just say, oh, Paul made it up. And first, I would say there's not good evidence for that, because, well, here's the problem. I think a lot of people think that, oh, in the ancient world, people would believe anything you told them. They're like toddlers. They'll believe anything you told them. But that's not the evidence we have. In 1 Corinthians 15:12, Paul says there were people in Corinth who didn't believe there was a resurrection. So there were skeptics in his audience. They didn't believe there was a resurrection. In 2 Corinthians, he talks about the super apostles, the people who are trying to discredit him. So Paul has enemies. And when he cites evidence, those enemies could say, there are no such people. We can travel to Jerusalem once you're on Passover. We can talk to Christians there. There's no such people. So the fact that Paul, he says, some of them are still, have fallen asleep, have died. Others are still alive. You can talk to them. He feels confident enough, not just to pass on the 500 as a creed that he received, but that I can vouch for this, that some of these people are still alive. And the other point on the 500 I would have brought up if it came up in the debate, if it is a legend, what's so weird about it to me is that I would have asked Doug, do legends grow over time? He would say, absolutely. Okay, where is the narrative of the appearance to the 500 in the Gospels? And it's not explicitly there. I think it might be in Matthew 28, the appearance in Galilee. I think that's highly probable. But it's so interesting to me that you say, oh, they make legends all the time. But the gospel authors, they show restraint. Like they don't cook up an appearance. They don't cook up an appearance to James or to Peter or to the 500. So I think people got to check their preconceptions there. I threw out a lot, but I'm sure you got some thoughts too.
Oh, sure. Me personally, I wouldn't hammer down on the 500 too hard.
I don't think it's the strongest, but I don't think it's something we should throw away.
I wouldn't necessarily throw it away. I would just say, unless we know what the experience was like, it makes it difficult to, like I've been kind of saying, to assess the rationality if they were to believe it. Sure. And so I don't think it's like the strongest, but I think it as part of a cumulative case, I think it has some evidential weight. I would just say that in order to make a strong case of the resurrection, what it all boils down to is that we're trying to do this end run around the Gospels, as if the Gospels are just kind of like this ugly girlfriend that we're kind of ashamed to be in public with. I hate to use that analogy.
But well, yeah, I've kind of done that too, as a shortcut to say, fine, it's full of contradictions, whatever, but you can't deny these bedrock facts. But I feel like I shouldn't have to do that. My girlfriend is very attractive. My wife is very attractive. But to say, no, you think it's full of contradictions. And like, it's granting. Do you think maybe apologists, we grant too much for a bad reason?
Oh, yeah. I mean, here's Dr. Craig, who I have a ton of respect for. I'm
William Lane Craig.
I'm a chapter director. But he says, this is in one of his like Q&As that he has on his website.
Right.
He says, I almost never argue with an unbeliever about inerrancy. I'll concede for the sake of our argument, virtually all the errors and inconsistencies in the Old and New Testament that he wants to bring up, while insisting that the documents collected into what later is called the New Testament are fundamentally reliable when it comes to the central facts undergirding the fate of Jesus of Nazareth. And I'm just like, can we really do that and grant all of the things that the skeptic brings up? Why are we doing this? What it seems like it's a sociological thing of like, well, the majority of scholars right now have a low view of the Gospels. And so we just got to kind of argue on their turf. And it's just like, well, maybe the majority of scholars have these sociological factors that are driving them a little bit, and their arguments aren't really that good. I mean, I've read a lot of Ehrman, and I don't really find a lot of his list of alleged contradictions to really be all that good. And there's also a lot of really good positive evidence for the reliability of the Gospels that I think we're just kind of chucking by the wayside. And I don't think that there's any, I think it's more of like the older argument that William Paley kind of put out there, that the disciples were either deceived or deceivers or were telling the truth. It's just fallen out of fashion because of guys like D.F. Strauss came along later and said, well, you know, and threw out a bunch of bad reasons why we shouldn't trust the Gospels. And I think we need to push back on that and say, no, the Gospels are robustly reliable. When Doug said, like, would you believe just on the basis of now, I'm going to bite the bullet here. Would you believe just based on the Gospel of John? I would say maybe I might be inclined to, because I think John is very, and this is a very unpopular opinion, but I think John is very reliable. He gives all kinds of eyewitness details that are just...
Craig Blumberg, for those who are listening, has a good book just on the reliability of John's gospel. It's very fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I would say, well, why are we just chucking that aside. I mean, Lydia right. McGrew has a really good book, Eye of the Beholder, that makes an argument for the reliability of the Gospels. Why are we conflating sociology with epistemology?
Well, also, I would say that sometimes, well, I have two thoughts on here. One, I think Craig's point can be interpreted in a way that we would all kind of agree, in that you don't have to prove inerrancy.
No.
Idea that right. something is completely without error whatsoever.
Right.
But I think there's a conflation here between inerrancy and reliability. Mm-hmm. That, you know, there's most things we deal with in life are highly reliable, and they might have some errors in them. Even like the technical manuals for our machines probably have typos and stuff like that in them, but they're still very reliable. So I right. think we can say, look, I'm not going to try to prove divine inerrancy, because that's another theological issue. I'm just saying it's historical, it's reliable. But the minimal facts can help to kind of, I think what I'm growing towards is the idea that the minimal facts are like the appetizer, and then historical reliability is like the main course. Like, okay, this gets us through the door, and then I want to buttress it with all this other great stuff I have.
I would say, I might take a harder stance. I would say the minimal facts, what it will get you to is that the disciples had experiences that they interpreted as appearances, mm-hmm. and that they were probably willing to, we know that they were willing to suffer for right. that. Okay. And so now we need to know, were they rational in believing those experiences?
Yeah.
And I think the only way to do that is to defend the reliability of the Gospels. If we could say that the Gospels are at least what the apostles originally claimed, what I'm trying to do is I want to get the skeptic to go, okay, they made it up. They were lying. Okay. I want to push them away from the they were mistaken hypothesis. Mm-hmm. Because that's they can throw out all kinds of brief, fleeting experiences and say that's consistent with minimal facts. And so I want to take that option away and push them more in the direction of they must have been making this stuff up. And that's where I think where the rubber really meets the road. And mm-hmm. that's where I want to bring all of the evidence that we have for the robust reliability of the Gospels to show that, no, that they were consistently honest and close up to the right. facts and habitually truthful and all of those different things, and show that it is based on eyewitness testimony. And so if they were lying, then why in this context of suffering, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Right.
Does that make sense?
No, it does. And I think a problem with the minimal facts approach is, and I've seen this sometimes when Gary Habermas does debates and things like that, is you'll try to say, I'm only using the facts that all scholars or nearly all scholars agree on. I'm only using these facts, and look at all scholars agree, you know, you'll like try to be on a roll. All scholars agree on crucifixion. All scholars agree that the disciples claim to have appearances. And all an atheist, an opponent has to do in the debate is to say, okay, well, Gary, what do those critical scholars, like Doug will do this. He'll say, do the majority of critical scholars think Jesus walked on water? He did that in his interview with Gary when he had him on the show. Well, no. Okay. So, you know, the majority of critical scholars will not, won't agree on a lot of these other things that you do believe in. And so that kind of, it undermines your case a bit. I also love, you have a pinned tweet on your Twitter account, and I love it. You know, well, what you believe, mainstream New Testament scholarship doesn't hold to that view. But mainstream New Testament scholars, they can't even agree on who Jesus is. Right. There is no uniform view about, to say the question, who was Jesus? Was he an apocalyptic prophet? There's disagreement. Was he a cynic sage? There's disagreement. You know, they can't even agree amongst themselves. So why can't I have my particular view? And we all, you know, we all go out there. And also just this whole thing like, oh, you're this fringe view. Well, Mark Goodacre right now, his denial of Q is technically, it's minority, but people don't think he's Looney Tunes for holding that view. It should be about the arguments you make.
If you are a minimal facts apologist, you already hold on to a fringe view, because you still have to, from second order facts is what Lacona and Habermas will call it, they'll have to argue for an empty tomb, which is not maybe 70% accept the empty tomb, maybe 60%.
And that's a hard one though, because I'm really skeptical of Gary's survey, like, oh, 70% of scholars hold to this. I'm worried there's a selection bias, that people who write about the empty tomb probably already believe in it. So I'm worried when he tries to do that.
Well, the other thing too is like, do the majority of scholars believe that the appearances were really group appearances? Right. I mean, I know Bart Ehrman doesn't. I'm not so sure. Maybe Dallison might. Do the majority of the scholars grant that they were physical in nature? No, not at all. Yeah. And so you're conflating, you're fuzzifying the data here. You're putting like, it's not specific. They're not granting the physicality experiences, the physical experiences. And I think you see a lot of popular level apologists do this. They'll try and use minimal facts, and they'll kind of sneak in like, well, yeah, and they're physical just like in the Gospels. And it's like, whoa, that's not a minimal fact.
Right.
Right. And also, if we want to use like, what else is a minimal fact? Well, if it's all about 90% of scholars being on board with a certain thing, and that includes skeptical ones and conservative ones, because, we got to keep our horizons in check.
Right.
Well, by that same logic, okay, well, the Apostle John didn't really write John. He felt free to invent all kinds of sayings and things and put it in Jesus's mouth, because we have majority of scholars who believe that, including some conservative ones like Craig Evans.
Right.
And so it's kind of like, is that really the kind of argument that we want to use? I mean, I think we want to push back on that and not, what if that falls out of fashion again? What if,
right.
What if mythicism comes fully into fashion?
Yeah.
You know, like it's possible. Do we really want to put so much of our eggs into a sociological fact of what a bunch of people believe? And also, where is this data? Like, yeah. I'd like to see, like, Gary, can you publish where you're getting this database of scholars? Where are you getting these percentages? It's like a black box. Has anybody seen it? I mean, we're just kind of having to take.
I thought he had an article about the empty tomb, but I don't know if it had all the citations in it. He claims that. Now, I would love to read this if it really is going to come about. Gary's going to do the magnum opus, the 5,500 page book defending the resurrection. And I would be stoked. I hope it comes out. You know, that's a mammoth undertaking. Yeah. Well, I also think one point I kind of brought up in the debate, it was implicit. It's an argument I kind of like from Andrew Loke to buttress the gospel argument, is that it would have required a bodily appearance to convince them of resurrection rather than spiritual survival. I think that should be put in tandem with the gospel appearances, but it's a cumulative case. For our listeners who want more actually on that and some of this other approach, I would definitely recommend, and we might have some other books you'd recommend as well. It's called Investigating the Resurrection of Jesus Christ, A New Transdisciplinary Approach by Andrew Loke, L-O-K-E. Some have called him the William Lane Craig of Asia. He's got a great book on the cosmological argument, solid guy. I definitely recommend that. So I think we've pulled everything together. So much more we could have talked about. Is there anything else you'd like to bring up or discuss or maybe point people towards and kind of the work you're doing to help them out?
Sure. No, I appreciate that. Again, channel is Testify. Just look up maybe Testify Apologetics. I have a playlist on why I think the minimal facts argument is problematic and what a maximal data case looks like. I talk a lot about the reliability of the Gospels. I think that the impression basically it seems like we've got is just, again, with kind of the ugly girlfriend analogy, is just like, and he even quoted like Lacona a little bit and was like, well, you know, they looks like, and maybe Lacona, he's probably taking Lacona a little bit out of in a way that Lacona himself wouldn't agree with. But
yeah.
I think we have good arguments for the robust reliability of the Gospels, and even a lot of popular Christian apologists, and it's not putting anybody down or anything like that,
right.
Have just kind of downplayed and poo-pooed the Gospels to the point where people are, you almost get the impression with just people I deal with online that they're not even sure if they can use them as sources. And what I'm saying is, no, there's lots of really good arguments for the reliability of the Gospels. I would definitely, check out my channel. There's lots of good books I could recommend. Lydia McGrew's book on undesigned coincidences called Hidden in Plain View is a really good one. She's written a book called Eye of the Beholder on the reliability of the Gospel of John that, like I mentioned earlier, is very helpful. Peter J. Williams has a really good, short, easy entry-level book called Can We Trust the Gospels? And so my slogan is let's man up and defend the Gospels, not just do this undrun approach around the Gospels and just kind of rely on Paul, because as we had discussed, Paul can only take us like
so far
to so far. Yeah.
And I'd also recommend people, if you want a good resource that's coming up soon. Super excited about this. Catholic Answers is hosting a debate between our senior apologist, Jimmy Akin, and Bart Ehrman on the question, are the Gospels historically reliable? So definitely go and check that out. That's going to be March 24th at 7 p.m. Pacific time. It'll be broadcast. I think it's going to be live streamed on the Catholic Answers YouTube channel. Check that out. Jimmy Akin versus Bart Ehrman. Are the Gospels historically reliable? You're not going to want to miss that. Eric, thanks so much for coming on the show. I'll have to have you back to talk more reliability of the Gospels sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be glad to. Thanks again for having me. It was awesome.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much. And wait, once again, website is isjesusalive.com.
Isjesusalive.com. Yep.
And the YouTube channel is Testify. Go and check it out, everybody. Thank you, guys. Don't forget to subscribe to this channel and to support us at TrenthornPodcast.com. I hope you all have a very blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrenthornPodcast.com.